You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko India tōku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, welcome to The Wire for Tuesday the 3rd of October. I'm joined by my producer Mac and Lucy in studio. How are you, Mac?
I'm doing well, thanks.
That is good. Coming up on the show today, we speak to the Aged Care Association about the rest homes who have been forced to close in the wake of the pay equity deal for care workers that was passed earlier this year. World Wildlife Fund New Zealand is celebrating a potentially record number of kereru. We speak to CEO Olivia Easterhazy. On the Green Desk, our new producer Jack Marshall looks at how climate change could impact New Zealand's vineyards. We talk to a New Zealand researcher concerned with the growing global influence of China. Lucy spoke to a lecturer at Waikato University about New Zealand statistics changing the way they report on iwi. And BFM reporter Sam Smith speaks to Tina Plunkett from Save the St. James about the future of the theatre. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover, please give us a call 309 3879 or send us a text on 5395.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
The government's $2 billion pay equity settlement was celebrated as a win for care workers when it was passed in April, after it was argued that low rates of pay was due to gender discrimination under the Equal Pay Act. Since then, many rest homes have struggled to meet the cost of rising wages and are having to restructure, cut jobs, or even close their doors. The Aged Care Association, who represent 90% of New Zealand's aged care sector, say they support the pay equity settlement and celebrated it being passed earlier this year. However, Chief Executive Simon Wallace says what's happened since then is that because the settlement isn't fully funded and has also been implemented very quickly, it has put more homes in trouble than anyone predicted.
We're finding that a number of our members, around about 100 of our 600 members, are having to look at their options going forward to be able to stay in business.
And so I saw that the Ministry of Health have come out and said that it is fully funded. So what is that discrepancy? Is it something to do with the time frame or...?
There are two key factors influencing the funding problem. One of those centres around an averaging funding formula, so it's based on an average experience level of the staff, it's based on an average level of qualification of your staff, and it's based on average care hours per resident per day. Now, if you sit above those averages, you're having to make up that difference yourself. So when you've got very experienced staff that are highly qualified, you're having to make up that difference. And then the second factor is what has been called the qualification equivalency process. So that means that international registered nurses, for example, that are working here as caregivers, they may have been working at level one or level two on the qualifications framework. We are now having to pay those people on level three or level four on the framework, and that means a difference of $2 to $4 per hour more that we're not getting funded for.
So could you talk me through some of the ways that homes are dealing with this problem? So I saw that there was restructuring, they don't have to fully close. What other kind of measures are they taking?
So the Aged Care Association is working with the DHBs, and our members that are at risk have been encouraged to talk with their own district health board about their particular situation. So some of those discussions are happening. But really, as a business going forward, they're having to look at their model, and that does mean making staff redundant. That does mean reducing the number of care hours that they give to residents each day, and in some cases that means closing, and we've already seen foreclosures around the country because of the settlement since the 1st of July. And this is not the result that any of us had wanted because of the pay equity settlement.
Was it something that you were worried about when it was passed? Were you celebrating but also a little bit worried, or has this come out of the blue?
Yes, the Aged Care Association did tell the government prior to April, so prior to the settlement being finalised, that the way that this was being funded could mean that some rest homes would struggle, and that has proved to be the case. But I don't think any of us would have anticipated that there would have been this many in trouble, and I don't think any of us would have thought that rest homes would be thinking of closing. And that has a very real impact for particularly small communities and rural communities where that rest home can be the only service in that town and where they actually sustain jobs in those communities.
So what will happen to people who rely on those services? Will they have to sort of go further afield, or what will happen?
Well, that would be the worst possible scenario for people to have to move away from their family and their community when they're very sick. And we are impressing upon the government that we don't want that to be the case. That's the last possible option, and we just have to be able to work with government and with officials so that these rest homes can stay open and can continue to provide those services and sustain those jobs.
What sort of response have you had from the government? Because it was just seemed like such a celebratory thing that they, at the time, and now, I mean, I haven't seen too many comments from them in the coverage so far. Have you heard from anyone from the ministry?
So the Aged Care Association is working with the Ministry of Health and with DHBs, and there are around about 30 providers that are currently in discussions with their DHB about some kind of transitional financial assistance to at least get them through the next 6 to 12 months. Sometimes those conversations are very difficult to have because as soon as a rest home puts its hand up and identifies itself as at risk, that can impact the referrals that those DHBs are passing on to rest homes. So that's a difficult discussion to have, and DHBs themselves are under fiscal pressure. We've actually got to be able to look at a longer term solution to that. We have a funding review of aged residential care coming up in the next 12 months, and that will provide hopefully some medium to long term solutions, but it won't get rest homes through the next year.
Do you have any sort of idea of a figure of how much of a shortfall there is at the moment across aged care?
We don't have an indication of the collective amount. I know from talking to my members that they can have very small deficits. They can be as much as 25,000-30,000 up to 100,000 or more. But when you're running a small rest home, that is a deficit that your board won't allow to run long term. So this is the issue that rest homes are having. It's not going to need a lot of money to find some solutions here and at least get people through the next 12 months.
Do you mean that rest homes are scared to put their hand up to say that they're struggling, because that will kind of create a bit of a downward cycle where they'll get less people going there and then less resources, and it could end up being worse for them? Is that what you mean?
What members are telling me is that once they identify themselves as financially at risk, that in itself can create a reputational issue. So the DHBs themselves are providing referral residents, but also in the wider community, you can identify yourself as being financially at risk and possibly not sustainable, and therefore question why you would want to send a loved one to that particular rest home. So it's a difficult conversation to have.
Can anyone explain why the modern day Wales are so big?
The Wire.
That was Aged Care Association Chief Executive Simon Wallace. It's 11 minutes past 12. The latest great kereru count shows the native bird might be making a resurgence. Run by WWF New Zealand, the count asks people each year to report sightings of kereru online. This year, more than 13,000 kereru were counted, more than 1,500 on last year. WWF New Zealand CEO Olivia Esterhazy told me earlier that despite record numbers, we don't know for sure yet if this is a population increase.
We can't sort of look at the numbers and go, yes, they're looking more than last year and therefore the kereru are doing better, because it could be observation counts themselves versus the actual kereru. So that's why the Vic Uni needs about 7 to 10 years worth of solid data. So it's brilliant in terms of the observations have increased, and that's what we're looking for predominantly. And also obviously good news that, you know, there's a huge amount of kereru numbers, which is great. But until we get the final, you know, from the scientists themselves saying, yes, they're increasing or they're a healthy population or what have you, we won't know for sure.
So, but you are having more people kind of engaging with this count. And, and it's a cool initiative, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the exciting thing. So the fact that there are more people engaged means the data's a hell of a lot stronger. You know, it's much stronger data for the scientists to number crunch with. So very, very exciting. And the exciting part as well was the people. For the first time ever, we had Kiwis spotting kereru from like far north, like Kataya, all the way like to the deepest of south, even Stewart Island, which was never happened before. Like that sort of a spread was brilliant.
So there may be kind of some indication that the population is at the very least kind of diversifying over the region?
Well, the observations diversified. So, you know, observers actually started to record their observations as far north and as far south, as I mentioned. What we don't know is whether those kereru were there last year, but the observers didn't record, if that makes sense. But so the more accurate we have, so hopefully next year with the count, if we can get people recording in Kaitaia again and, you know, all the way down south, then, you know, we'll get a much better story. The story will start to really come to life.
Yeah, historically we've had kind of concerns as far, I mean, the usual threats and the pests in New Zealand to the kereru, and also things like 1080. But, I mean, where do you think the situation currently stands?
So, yeah, so, I mean, the big threats obviously are, as you mentioned, the pests, you know, in terms of their nests, et cetera, et cetera. The other one is window strike as well, and as well as that, deforestation. So they're the ones that actually eat the largest fruit of our big native trees. And so, you know, to help them stay healthy, you know, we're asking Kiwis to plant as many native trees as possible, because they're essentially the gardens of the sky. So not only is this project about ensuring the health of their species, it's also there to ensure the health of our native forests, because without the kereru, they don't regenerate.
Yeah. Would you look at rolling this out, this app, out to perhaps other species?
Good question. I'm sure we could look at doing the same sort of count for other species that are not endangered. The reason why we do this count as a citizen count is because the kereru is not considered endangered, so it doesn't have a formal counting system. So if there are any other animals out there, absolutely, why not? You know, share the love. If there's animals that need to be counted or species that need to be counted that are not already formally counted, then I don't see why not at all. It's there to be used and there to be helpful.
To understand the distinction,
Rewire. That was World Wildlife Fund New Zealand CEO Livia Esterhazy speaking about kereru numbers. It is 12:15. We're just going to a quick break and then we're back with the Green Desk.
Ladies 6 brings you the Alpha Sessions 3. Lee Sormel, October 20th and 21st. Not content to simply tour her excellent Royal Blue 3000 EP, Lady 6 and crew are taking their studio setup to the stage to improvise on new material and deconstruct catalogue classics. You made me feel so good. A properly one-off musical experience. Lady 6, The Alpha Sessions 3. With Sylvia MC, Jess B and Bailey Wiley. Lee Sormel, October 20th and 21st. For tickets and more information, go to ladies6.live.
Join us for our next Late at Auckland Museum, Invisible Privilege. Who wields the power and privilege in our society? And why do we need to confront our own privilege? Hear from moderator Russell Brown and panellists Richard Palmer-Tatou, Julia Faiporti, Tafanga A Norpera and Georgina Beyer. Book now, Late at the Museum, Invisible Privilege, Wednesday, October 11th. Tickets on sale now at aucklandmuseum.com.
Mate, I'm thirsty like a dog and heat for some good live music.
Jeez, man, just yuck.
What? No, you know, like when it's hot and the dog gets thirsty and it puts its tongue out and like...
Oh, look, come on, man, no! Just... Dear God!
Feeling the thirst? BFM's got you sorted with great live sessions every Friday evening on Drive, courtesy of The Thirsty Dog, 469 K-Road. Live and loud with The Thirsty Dog, every Friday Drive, only on BFM.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, get out.
What are you... Oh, my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, It's just music.
God, you're dropping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus. Come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1 to 4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon. Right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
Make yourself a oneness with the loving earth. It's time for the Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95BFM.
On the Green Desk this week, we don't have Lily. Instead, we have our new host, Jack Marshall. As climate change increases, there will be both benefits and costs to New Zealand's agricultural industries. Dr. Glenn Creasy, a senior lecturer in viticulture at Lincoln University in Christchurch, is looking at how New Zealand's vineyards will be impacted by changing climates. Jack spoke to Creasy and began by asking how exactly climate change might affect wider New Zealand.
The effects of climate change are something there's a lot of different models to sort of predict what's going to happen. And depending on the model, you can get lots of different answers to that question. But generally speaking, the east of the country will tend to get drier and warmer. The west actually might get a little bit wetter. But overall, people are mostly going to have to deal with less water, higher temperatures all year round, and again, more extreme weather events. So we'll have frosts that may occur later in the season, you know, in the springtime, or they might be more severe, or in the autumn we might have frosts that occur earlier or might be more severe. There'll be more severe weather events in terms of rainfall, possibly wind. So we can expect things to be a little bit more unexpected, I suppose.
It's not like everything kind of gets warmer. It's more like we just get more extremes. That's kind of my takeaway so far from what climate change is doing.
Yeah, it seems to be. We have plenty of evidence of that already, actually. Yeah.
Especially if you look to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And then so in these wine regions, like specifically are kind of a big hitters. So like in the South Island around Otago and things, what's going to happen around there? Because that's more inland.
Well, all the regions will be affected in some way, and I think that generally, you know, the most you can really say is that they're going to have to deal with less precipitation, although that precipitation may come, you know, in larger individual batches, or there may be extended drought periods that they may have to deal with. So that extreme area, there's a lot of frosts in many areas of central Otago, and so they can expect to have to deal with more frosts and perhaps more severe frosts. And that could have a direct impact on production in some of the more marginal areas particularly. And that holds true pretty much for all the other grape growing regions as well. In Marlborough, there are areas there where vines are grown quite far up into the valleys. And there they're a lot more exposed to colder temperatures in the springtime. And although they have systems in place to deal with this, the systems may not have been built to be robust enough to deal with some of the more severe events. And we may see changes in productivity from those areas and profitability of those vineyards over time.
And I've just been doing some research online, just some light Googling, and then on the New Zealand kind of program for climate change, it was saying that in general, a warmer climate will have benefits for subtropical fruits such as avocados and citrus, and then generally wine grapes will benefit if sufficient water is available. This sounds actually pretty good, to be honest. I mean, avocado production. But as long as we have enough water, we can get the grapes and things. But in terms of citrus and avocados, is that going to be something that's actually not affected too badly, apart from the frosts?
Well, I'm not an expert in those areas at all. But, I mean, yeah, it's a trade-off between having warmer temperatures. And that is beneficial for the grape industry a lot, too, because in a cool climate, we're often struggling, you know, to get grapes ripe enough to harvest before the weather sort of closes in the autumn. And if it's warmer, then we should have less of a struggle. But overall, it's a matter of that might be better, but then the more extreme events might make it a little bit harder to deal with in a practical sense. So with other crops, it'd probably be similar. There'll be bonuses maybe from climate change. And people talk about, for example, the carbon dioxide level has been increasing in the atmosphere for a long time. And it's actually quite a lot higher than it was, 50 years ago. because plants turn carbon dioxide into oxygen, you know, it's a food source for them, basically. And as the concentration rises, their productivity could rise as well. But, you know, there are a lot of other sort of potential downsides around that as well. So it's a complicated system, and one change can result in a lot of other changes. And a change that might be beneficial for one crop might be bad for another crop, or, you know, might have effects that make it less profitable to grow plants in that particular region. So we have to be a little careful about gross generalizations and climate change, because it's an amazingly complex system that we live on, this planet Earth.
The kind of environmental butterfly effect, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then So to keep it local, what do you drink and how will this affect your grapes that you drink?
Well, I drink all kinds of things. I like trying a wide variety of grapes, so I don't really have a favorite variety per se, but in any case, any of them would be affected by this. And in the longer term, so looking at, say, 50 to 100 years down the track, there will be such magnitude of change in temperature and the environment that we may see wine styles becoming different because the environment is that much warmer. So, for example, the Marlborough style of Sauvignon Blanc, which is hugely popular, is sort of a style that's based around the fact that it's quite cool in Marlborough, and we have a flavor profile of the grapes and the wine that is aspects of ripeness and aspects of greenness. And as the temperature increases, the aspects of greenness will fade away a little bit and we'll tend to get more ripe characteristics. So we won't be able to make the same style of wine as temperatures increase unless we change something. Either that could be management, or it might be the varieties or clones that we use, et cetera, et cetera. So the industry really has to be aware of what's going to happen, because things change relatively slowly in the grape industry because there's a high amount of investment and it's very expensive to replant a vineyard. If you're putting in a vineyard now, you might expect that its useful life might be 50 or 60 years. So, you know, although it may make a really nice wine now, towards the end of that vineyard's life, it may not be able to. So we need to be thinking about how we're establishing our vineyards, how we're designing our vineyards to be able to cope with what we predict will be, you know, what our environment will be in another 40 or 50 years. That's stuff that you need to think about now if you're putting in a vineyard. So the industry is it'd be the same if you're doing avocados. You have to think longer term, and, you know, climate change is real. So you need to think about, well, what will the environment be like when this orchard or vineyard is halfway through its useful life? And will I be able to make a product that the consumer wants if we have these kinds of changes? So it's a very forward-thinking kind of process in these industries.
Mm, yeah, I was thinking in somewhere like Gisborne, where we're mostly something like Chardonnay, it would probably be better to plant things like Cabernet or something that's kind of like...
Well, ultimately that could be very well. There's white varieties and red varieties that may do better there in another 40 years than Chardonnay is now. So, you know, there's a lot of crystal ball gazing going on, or there should be a lot of crystal ball gazing going on with these kinds of industries.
You would hope so, anyway.
Yeah.
And the other one is, what about beer?
Oh, beer. Well, interesting, because the thing about beer is that the complexity that you can have in beer is, to a large extent, determined by the brewer. So with wine, when you grow the grapes and you make the wine, often we're trying to do as little possible in the winery to express the grapes. The Marlborough style of Sauvignon Blanc is a really good example of that, because it really is essence of grape. There's not a lot of fiddling around that goes on in the winery. Whereas with beer, at least most people have the opportunity to take a range of ingredients, and they might source some of their ingredients from New Zealand, they might source some from Germany or the United States. And so they're sort of assembling a group of ingredients that will result in the beer that they want to make. So they have a lot more flexibility in that they can change the source of their materials to make the kind of beverage they want. So as long as you have the freedom to do that, climate change, in theory, shouldn't have much impact on the beer industry.
Mm. And then, so final, this is your crystal ball gazing, if you want to do it, but... do you see any new regions popping up in New Zealand? I'm thinking like, Stewart Island, Sauvignon Blanc, kind of as, you know, it gets getting colder, so you got to move further south, or even Auckland Islands, you know?
Region. Well, there definitely, you know, will be a shift as the temperature changes and we start to explore new regions. I mean, the wine industry is really a great one for innovation and taking risks, because a lot of the industry is really based around enthusiasm that people have for wine and saying, you know, I want to grow the next great Pinot Noir and I'm going to do it here. And they'll go ahead and put in some vines and just give it a go. So, you know, we will see people experimenting with new varieties, new wine styles, and new locations as things progress through time. And you may even see people doing a bit of speculation and saying, well, you know, this spot of land may not be right, you know, really good right now, but in another 20 years, it may actually be a decent place to grow, you know, this kind of grape. So we will see a little bit of a shift around.
So you're not going to give us any... You're not going to give us any hints to where they might be?
No, I wouldn't go that far.
You're not banking any land yet?
No.
You've been listening to The Green Desk with Lily Peacock on 95 BFM.
That was producer Jack Marshall speaking to Dr. Glenn Creasy, a senior lecturer in viticulture at Lincoln University, who has been looking at how New Zealand's vineyards will be impacted by climate change. Next, we have producer Lucy with her story.
So New Zealand Statistics have released an updated iwi statistical standards, which will help guide them on how best to collect, organise and describe iwi information. The new conditions separate individual iwi within the statistics in order to better reflect the contemporary needs for and about Māori. I asked Tangitu Huata from the University of Waikato why it's so important to update these standards.
It's imperative that we move away from the generic one-size-fits-all template and be quite specific in terms of the needs and the wants and the expectations of our Māori iwi and hapu. More so, it's about having a holistic approach and finding more contemporary and attractive ways and engaging with those communities to have more efficient methods in terms of collecting data for Statistics New Zealand.
So what issues will the changes address?
The issues will give a true representation. I mean, as we all understand, Māori are represented in a lot of our negative statistics. So getting in there and having a better understanding of what's not working and the sort of equation I've come up with was suffice consultation and getting the proper information plus constant engagement with those iwis and those communities can only equal true and meaningful representation of statistics, which in turn should allow us to deliver more efficient recommendations when looking at providing initiatives and services for these iwis and hapu.
So these changes mean that they separate iwi, and there's obviously a lot of difference from iwi to iwi, but is this going far enough? Does it not need to go further to understand the differences in hapu?
I think for a starting point, that would probably be the best place to start in terms of having a starting point to engage with the iwis and understand their expectations and understand how very different their needs and their processes are. And once, I guess, from there, it would probably be ideal, if possible, to look at expanding out into the hapu, into the hapori, the wider communities and the families as well. But I think that's a good starting point with the iwi. I think in time, hopefully, we'll look into expanding up into the wider hapu, etc.
But how diverse are the issues within iwi?
They tend to change, and I mean if we're working with the main set of body of those collectives, which would be the iwi representatives, or which would be the iwi themselves, they would probably be a lot more connected with their communities. So it probably would be suffice at this point to engage with them.
So what are the key issues that vary from, say, even the North Island to the South Island?
Well, other than the geographical location and the large land masses, because there's obviously, a lot more, they're very different in terms of location, communities. I mean, high population Māori communities up north is probably a lot more prevalent than what you would see down south. Not to say it's not down there, but just it's very different in terms of larger numbers, in terms of Māori people being in collectives in certain parts of rural communities in the north as well as down south. But it is imperative to understand that they are slightly different. However, engaging with the larger iwi entities will probably be a better way to engage with them in terms of statistics and gathering information.
So in terms of those statistics, what do you think would be the best outcome from these changes to the statistics?
More importantly for me, I think it would be finding a meaningful way to take this information and getting it gathered in a dignified way without feeling like you've just answered a question on a piece of paper and that's it, and now we're making lots of decisions on your behalf without you really fully understanding. I guess it's about enlightenment as well and understanding what's the whole ideals and purposes behind the statistics. And only until we have a true representation of what's truly going on within those communities by gathering this information, then the government can make and cater to those needs and expectations.
Any final comments?
I just want to just give a big mihi to kia koutou, kia whakarangatira tēnei kaupapa. Kia ora.
Irirangi Pōho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Tahanga Tangi Tuhuata from the University of Waikato speaking about changes to the way Statistics New Zealand engage with iwi. We have a quick break now, and then we're speaking to a researcher who has been looking into China's influence on New Zealand politics.
This is, excuse me, a damn fine cookie.